Welcome to Wise and Nice, a true crime podcast with your hosts
Danny Armstrong
and Kelly Lee.
Please remember that we mean no disrespect to anyone mentioned in this episode or across any of the Wise and Nice platforms. We have an interest in true crime and related topics, and whilst we may offer our own personal views on certain items, it is meant to be educational and as light-hearted as possible. The information we present is collated from research gathered from the internet, and we reference and credit our sources wherever possible.
If you've liked what you've heard and want to join in with us, follow us on our socials, Instagram, Wives and Knives the Pod, Twitter, at Knives Wives, and Facebook, Wives and Knives Pod. We also have a little website where we post photographs and other information about the cases that we research. And this is wivesandknives.wixsite.com/my site.
Hello and welcome to this week's episode of Wives and Knives.
Hello everybody.
I hope you all enjoyed the Jubilee.
Yeah, Platy Jubes.
Which was it last week?
Yeah.
I don't know, but it was
3, 2, 1, you're back in the room, babe.
Yeah.
It's because we record on a Sunday, so we were at the end, like, when we recorded last week, yes. We were at the end of it, weren't we?
When you
went back to work on Monday, like me, I felt, like, wiped out.
Yeah.
Because we'd had, like, extra days off.
Yeah.
It's just like, ugh. And I think everybody was like that.
Yeah, last week was the longest week ever.
I think the weather didn't help either. It was quite, like, muggy and stuff, which I find...
Draining. Gives
me a headache.
Yeah, we were done. Anyway, how's your week been? How are you?
Yeah, I'm good, thank you. Yeah, week's been nice. Busy at work. Took a day off to spend with my little bean. Because she had, like, an extended half term, so she had an extra week off. Literally cannot wait for her to go back to school. Love her to death, but I don't know where the fuck she gets her energy from. I'm like, oh my god, sometimes I'm like, have they given you speed? Like, when she's been with her grandparents, I'm like, what is this energy? I'm probably jealous, but
it's too much.
I went out for a meal on Friday. That was really nice. Just had a bit of a chill day. Went for a walk yesterday, but then it started raining, so it was quite nice just to hide under the trees and take some shelter.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, it was cute. That's about it. What about yourself?
Drowning in hay fever.
Itching eyes there.
Yeah, but apart from that, all good. This week lasted too long at work, but it was fine, everything's fine. I had a nice day yesterday and have loads of plans for kind of over the summer, so as long as I can summon enough energy,
there you go,
all is fine.
And we had an email off one of our listeners.
Yes, I sent it to you,
so that was nice to hear from you, Ray. Hope you keep him well. Have you heard about baby Holly?
No.
So, baby Holly, she vanished when her parents were murdered in 1980, and through familial DNA,
oh my god,
she has been found. She's been missing for over 40 years.
Wow.
And they found her. She is married, I think she's got like 5 kids, and obviously had no idea about her history. So, I mean, I guess it must be so hard for her,
yeah,
to discover, you know, like, what happened and stuff. I think it's reopened the case, like, to find out what actually happened.
Yeah, definitely.
Happened.
Like, who was she raised by, or is
exactly.
It all a bit of a shush at the moment?
I think she was obviously adopted, but then it's like the motivation for the adoption then, isn't it? And sort of looking into that and who was involved in it and who had then no doubt had links to her parents being violently murdered.
Wow, no, I hadn't heard anything about that.
It's quite big. And then I guess as well, it also sort of gives maybe a bit of hope to those people who've had children go missing. You know,
definitely.
There's always, it has happened quite a lot, hasn't it? You know, like, was it Natasha Campish or something? Yeah. So yeah, there are a lot of cases where people are discovered years later.
Yeah, decades. It's madness.
Yeah. So there's that. Oh, Britney's got married.
Has she?
Yeah.
I feel like I get like a news update off you. What's been happening in the world outside?
Yeah, congratulations to Britters.
Who is she married?
Ashgari.
Oh, her boyfriend.
Yeah. Yeah, and oh my god though, you know that guy that she was married to for like about 55 hours, I wanna say Jason Alexander. So he broke into her house and live streamed it. Like the day before or the day of her wedding.
How like bizarre and terrifying behaviour.
So that's a bit random. I think that's about it. Yeah. So what have you got for us today?
So today I'm going to be telling you about the case of Rachel McLean. I think it's pronounced McLean and not McLean.
Okay.
McLean, we're going with. And this is a case that I have always been like interested in because she was actually born and her family were from the same area as like that I grew up in as well. So it was a case that I've always sort of thought everyone was aware of. But when I've actually come to research it, and you know when you think you know something and then you actually try and write about it and you're like, nah, I don't know anything. It isn't as widely covered.
It's not at all.
There was a documentary about it, which we'll link in the sources, that's available on YouTube. That's really, like, I think it's a good documentary. But apart from that, coverage on, like, other podcasts has been very minimal, so I thought it would be a good opportunity to tell her story.
Excellent.
There we go.
I like it when we do that. Like, give a bit more sort of awareness and publicity to cases that aren't over publicised.
Yeah.
Because considering this is quite, I know its roots are quite local to us, it's not, I've not really heard much about it.
Well, there we go. So it happened back in 1991. At that time, Rachel was 19 years old. She was from Blackpool, from a little village called Carlton that's just sort of on the outskirts. And she was full of life, really into heavy metal music. She was that type of gal. I think I'd have been friends with her if we were sort of the same age. I think we could have well been friends, definitely. Even from like the places that she used to go out in Blackpool, I'm like, yes. She was really clever and she worked really hard as well. Got mega high grades, which ended up getting her a place at Oxford University. So clever, cool, funny, friendly, all the nice things. And she was going to uni to study English language. She was the eldest of three. Her dad, Malcolm, was a British aerospace engineer, and her mum, Joan, was head of languages at a local high school. So Rachel was actually living at 25 Argyle Street in Oxford while she was studying at uni, and she had a boyfriend called John Tanner. So John was studying at Nottingham Uni, and he was originally from New Zealand. He too was outgoing and popular. He played in the local football team. He ran a radio show for the uni, and he was a student union rep. So well thought of at his uni. Some of his friends speak on the documentary, and they were like, he was super popular with women because he was confident, funny, bright, all these things. So Rachel and John had actually met in Blackpool on her 19th birthday. He had been working in the resort over the summer at a bar called Adam and Eve, which is like a bar nightclub. Have you ever been in Adam and Eve?
No. Is it still there now?
No.
Oh, okay.
It shut down a little before I was of clubbing age.
Right.
But I remember the building and stuff like that. Anyway. So they met and they hit it off straight away. Like, there was an instant connection, and she thought he was fucking impressive, and he obviously thought the same of her. And they spent most weekends together, despite living, when they both went back to uni, living quite far apart. They would make the effort to travel by train to spend time with each other, and obviously this was before text messaging and stuff, so they'd write love letters to each other constantly. So sorry, I'm a bit hay fevery and I sound like I'm gonna,
no offense, but your eyes look like you've had a smoke. Really gassy and
So sorry if this is transcending into my voice. Now we skip forward to a couple of months into their relationship. I think it was about 8 months. I've not worked out properly. But again, 1991, and it's April, Tuesday the 16th, and her housemate is called Helen, who lived with Rachel, returns after spending some time at her home, back to her uni accommodation, and realises that Rachel isn't there. So my initial thought is like, why didn't she just drop her a text? But she bloody can't, because it's 1991. So I assume if someone wasn't there, they just weren't there, and there was nothing you could really...
Yeah, I guess you'd maybe call her parents on the landline if you were super worried.
Well, I don't think Helen was. Like, they're both grown-ups.
Yeah, exactly.
Obviously, Rachel often spends time in Nottingham, so there was not much concern. She just wasn't at the flat. So 3 days later, there was still no sign of Rachel. John has actually started calling, asking where she is. So Helen realises she's not with John, but again she thinks, well, maybe she's gone home, like it's kind of his problem to find her.
Yeah.
And I don't think, from reasons we'll find later on, Helen isn't the biggest fan of John, so she's just like, she'll call, she's clearly don't want to speak to you, like leave her alone kind of thing. But there's still no major concern over Rachel's whereabouts. Not until 5 days later, when she didn't show up for one of her exams, and her principal, if they keep referring to the university as a college, but I think it's split, the university split into colleges, and her college was called St. Hilda's, but the principal actually reports a missing to the police. So Rachel's mother was really proactive in giving press interviews and getting the word out there to help find Rachel, because she was concerned this sort of lack of contact with her family was super unusual. She would contact them every couple of days. They were quite close, and to not hear from Rachel just was unusual. So it wasn't that the police weren't taking this seriously. When she was reported missing, the police did start looking for her, but as you can imagine, quite a lot of students went missing for a few days at a time, especially when there wasn't sort of social media and this constant communication we have now. So maybe now a lack of communication would be more of a concern than it was then. And I think it took me a while to kind of realise that when I was researching this case, because I'm like, she's been missing 8 days. Like, why is, like, things only ramping up now? Or it's been almost a week. But then if somebody stayed at a friend's, they might not specifically, I mean, have the means of contacting people like they would these days.
Yeah, and I think students as well who have like several bases, mm-hmm. and there's like travel time and things like that, you know what I mean? It's usually a little bit more justified.
Yeah, but like I said, it wasn't that the police weren't taking this seriously, it's just it wasn't as fraught as it might have been now. So the police do search Argyle Street and nothing is missing to indicate that she'd gone away for a few days or gone to stay with a friend or anything like that. So they decide to speak to her friends, and her friends like start to talk about John and her relationship with John, and they say like, yeah, he's dead smart, dead funny, like life and soul of the party, but he's jealous as fuck and it was really becoming a problem. He would call up all the time, like if Rachel was out with her friends, he would call up and be like, what time did she leave, who did she go with, what was she wearing,
oh wow,
things like that, and really quiz her friends. And recently this had been pissing Rachel off. I think from the way her friends speak, it was one of those things that at first it's kind of like, oh my god, he's so like into me, and then it gets to a point where it's like, that's not what this is, this is controlling. So John's behaviour had definitely been noted as concerning to her friends, and like I said, around this time, it's about 8 days after she went missing, and the media interest is really strong, like it was widely reported at the time. And a letter is sent from John to Rachel, arrives at her house in Argyle Street, so it must have been sent a few days before that. And this letter says that John is on the train having left her at the station. So he's supposedly writing it on the train, gonna post it when he gets back to Nottingham. And he mentions how much he'll miss her and how he waved her off and she was smiling, and how sad he is to be writing this letter, leaving her smiling face. And in the letter, he mentions that, isn't it good that you bumped into that friend at the station, and how he'd offered you a lift home, and how, like, nice of him it was to do this. Well, this stuck out to the police straight away. So former Chief Inspector Laurie Fay of the Thames Valley Police, speaking on the Real Crime Love You to Death documentary, said that the mention of this friend didn't fit with the jealous person that they knew John to be, because he was saying things like, oh, wasn't it nice of that guy that we bumped into to give you a lift. So they know John, he's jealous and doesn't like her spending time with anybody else. He's not going to be like, oh yeah, it's really nice that this guy we've just met that you bumped into, that you and I didn't, that's giving you a lift home. So they think like this letter is off. Now we're at 9 days after Rachel disappeared, and Oxford CID take the trip to Nottingham to take an additional statement from John. And this is what he said. On Monday, the 15th of April, I was staying at Rachel's in Oxford. I woke up at midday and found Rachel studying, and then we made love. Just for the tape, Kelly's eyes rolled so hard. He said then he had a shower and he packed to go back to Nottingham. At 4:15, they both left the house and got the bus to the train station. When we were at the train station, Rachel saw a friend of hers in the cafe and they spent some time together, all three of them. At 6:20, they embraced on the platform and said goodbye, and he got on the train. John mentions this mystery friend, but says he doesn't know his name. But he does say, like, give a description of him. And the person that John's describing looks very much like John himself. So John had quite long hair, quite tall, brought like a kind of like rocker look to me.
Yeah, he's not like, he's not unattractive.
No, and the guy he describes, very similar, long hair, but... Come on, Joe, you can get out.
Get comfy. Good boy. Who's a good boy?
Sorry, my dog has just joined us on the sofa. So the police again find this suspicious. There was something off about the letter, him being so sort of chill about her going off with this mystery man, but the fact the mystery man doesn't have a name, that none of her friends know who this mystery man could be, like there's loads of red flags. And the police suspect that he's like trying to build his alibi with these specific times that he's mentioned. So, two police officers are assigned to keep John up to date on the case. That's what they tell John anyway. They're like almost like a family liaison officer kind of role. And John is so confident and full of bravado. He basically takes these two guys on as his mate. Is like, oh, we're all friends now kind of thing. But really, they're keeping an eye on him. And like I said, John treats them as mates. He like... he's offering them drinks and he definitely thinks that he is above suspicion, but he was not. So the police are searching all over Oxford. They are pretty sure that John has something to do with her disappearance, but without finding Rachel alive or her body, they don't really have that much to go on. 12 days after Rachel went missing, Johnny is carrying on his life as usual. He's playing with his football team and acting like nothing much has happened. And quite a few people from his uni actually contact the police because they are suspicious of how little it is affecting him. I just thought that was interesting to note.
But yeah, definitely.
John is popular and he does have a core group of friends who see him as like, he's a really nice guy. So he does have his supporters as well, who just see him as a friend. But the media have decided that there's something fishy going on and there's a lot of pressure on the police to sort of act. And the media are really flooding the university. Like, they're turning up at his house that he lives, and his friends are like, go away and leave him alone. Like, he's not done anything. But the media thought differently. And to the police, he was their only suspect, although he didn't know that. And the police asked John to do a press interview, but they spoke with the press first and asked them specific questions. Like I said to the press, will you ask these questions? Because we want to see his reaction.
That's clever.
Yeah. So John agreed and he thought it was great. Like, this was his chance to kind of change what the media thought of him. And he really tried to present himself as the victim of this. Like, it's so hard for me with my girlfriend missing, and it's like, it's affecting me, and you should all feel really bad for me. Like, that was what he was saying. But he was so emotionless when actually talking about Rachel, and it was at that moment and because of that interview that some of his friends who speak on the documentary now saw him do that interview and were like, God, we don't know this guy at all. Like, in that moment,
yeah,
they realised that the person they'd been friends with was just a mask. So during the interview, he was asked directly if her disappearance had anything to do with him. And he answered, not to my knowledge. And then he gives a quick smirk. And you can really see this, it's so telling. He's also asked, do you think Rachel is still alive? And he says, I'd like to think so. So, not necessarily the answers you'd expect.
No.
And he wasn't begging for someone to let her go or anything like that. It's an odd interview to watch. And the police were sure that he had done something to Rachel. And this just cemented everything for them. They were like, we know it's him, but they still lacked evidence. And they thought, well, we need to keep him involved because he's making us more and more sure that we're on the right track. So the police actually invited him to play himself in a reconstruction to see if anyone remembered them at the station, because of course John spun this story that there was like him, the mystery long-haired man, and Rachel at the station together. And so the police say to him, like, we want to do a reconstruction of her last movements, and John is only like more than happy to help them with this. He's like, yes,
I fucking loved that,
I will do this. So Rachel was played by a police officer, and the mystery long-haired man was played by like an actor, and John played himself. So they reconstructed the movements that John said happened that day, and a witness did come forward. Now, this was a lady called Jane Wynne Jones, and she recognised John, but John alone. She said he was there, but he was alone at the station. There was no Rachel and no long-haired man. And she remembered him vividly. She was sat next to him at the station, and she'd seen him writing the letter and what the letter had said. She said he was scribbling next to her on a small line notepad. He seemed agitated, and he was writing that he was on the train, but he wasn't.
Oh.
And she'd seen all this. So she tells the police, and they're like, fantastic. Like, they knew he was bullshitting, but now there's someone independent that's saying that's the case also. And they also decide to dig into the bus records. So there wasn't CCTV or anything on the buses, but there was a system that showed how many tickets were issued at each stop. And the stop that John said he'd got on with Rachel, only one ticket was issued. So one person got on the bus there. There was no way that Rachel could have been with him at that point. So the police look at plans of Rachel's house, 25 Argyle Street, the one at Oxford. And because they're like thinking, oh, we've searched a house, but they look and realise that there's a very, very small like space underneath the floorboards, like almost like a crawl space that they hadn't looked in.
Did they request the plans or something?
Yeah,
and it's like been underpinned or something, which I don't know what that means, but it creates a
It's like a small cold gap. So now we're on to the 2nd of May, and it's 18 days since she went missing, and the police go to 25 Argyle Street and rip up the floorboards, and there they find Rachel's body. She has been strangled. The two officers that had been dealing closely with John went to the student union, where I believe he was at the time, and asked him to come outside, and then they arrested him. He was taken to the station, and he was questioned extensively, and he just says nothing. Like, he doesn't say no comment, he literally doesn't speak, staring. And this goes on and on, and the police are pissed off with him. Like, I don't have transcripts or anything that was said, but the documentary reenacted it as to the police like going, come on, John, and that's how I imagine it, whether it was true or not. But eventually they do kind of break him, and he starts crying. Okay. And he says that they had an argument, and this is obviously only according to John, but he said that he'd asked Rachel to marry him, and she hadn't seemed keen on the idea, and she said that she'd been seeing somebody else. He lunged out at her, and then the next thing he remembers, he was sat on the bed and she was dead. So his story seems to be like, yeah, I did kill her, but it was loss of control. I was provoked.
Yeah, I was going to say.
He's trying to, what he considers, make it, like, justifiable. There was never actually, like, any sort of proof that she'd been seeing anyone else. None of her friends said she had. However, that isn't, like, cause at all. But, like, I think he was trying to justify his actions.
Yeah, sounds like it.
When they're unjustifiable. So the police have got him, and he's admitted that he was the one who took her life away. And it progresses quite quickly, because the trial was only a few months later in December. And he was back to being really composed again now. He was thinking he could control this situation. He admitted murder, but he wanted manslaughter. He again portrayed himself as the victim, saying how much he loved her and he would never have intentionally killed somebody who he loved so much. He said he was provoked and betrayed by Rachel, that she had played with his emotions and it was a loss of control, and really the person he'd hurt the most through his actions was himself, because he loved her so much.
Oh, fuck.
However, they had discovered Rachel's diary, and this was read out at the trial and showed that she'd fallen out of love with John quite a while ago, and she was scared and a bit like, oh, she didn't sort of know how she'd get out of this relationship because he was obviously so obsessed with her. But it showed how controlling he was, how manipulative, how he made her feel like she didn't have a way out. Mm-hmm. In the documentary, there's some diary extracts read, but I don't know if it's like paraphrased, right, or whether that was what she put. But according to the documentary, she'd written that, like, she had to write a Valentine's card to him, and really she just wanted to say, like, something along the lines of, you're disgusting and childish and I'm sick of you, and but she felt she couldn't, and things like that. So, yeah, her diary really exposed his behaviour. According to the pathology reports, John had initially strangled her with his hands, but then had moved to using a tea towel. So that too kind of went against his, like, loss of control, because the changing from kind of one weapon of his hands to another shows sort of thought, and maybe he wasn't getting the desired effect with his hands, which is a horrible way to put it, but you get what I mean.
Yeah.
And it proved that he had lied time and time again. The letter that he'd sent showed that he'd plotted, tried to create an alibi. Like, this wasn't a loss of control where he'd been like, oh my God, what have I done, and called the police. Like, he had covered his tracks. And it was possibly coincidental, possibly not, that quite often Helen, Rachel's, like, housemate, flatmate, would be there as well, and this one weekend she wasn't, so there was a chance that it had been even more premeditated. So the jury convict him of murder. They see that he's an absolute liar, and it's a 10-2 majority, and he is sentenced to life. However, he only served 12 years, which is absolutely fucking disgusting. And in 2003, he moved back to New Zealand. So, what, he'd have only been like early 30s then?
Shocking.
Yeah, absolutely disgusting. Anyway, that's not the last we hear of John Tanner, because in 2018, he was sent to prison again for 2.5 years. For abuse of his most recent girlfriend, including strangulation. Now, luckily, she escaped him, but absolutely disgusting that he did something so similar again. And as far as I know, and I could find out, he's now actually free and living in New Zealand.
Wow.
So
that's not good enough, I don't think. What, 2.5 years? Yeah. Okay, he didn't kill her, thankfully, but it's just showing that he is still the same person.
He's an absolute danger, yeah, to anybody, Rachel, who gets in a relationship with him.
Jesus Christ. Yeah. Oh my God, that's really worrying.
Definitely. And it's a horrible tale of a controlling relationship, and as is publicised a lot, the most dangerous time during a controlling relationship is when you actually leave.
Yeah.
So all we can assume is that Rachel tried to finish things with him, and that's what happened.
So sad.
So yeah, I know you said you'd heard of the case, but you didn't know.
I didn't know all of the intimate details, to be fair. Like, I didn't know that Rachel's diary had been read out and things like that were used in evidence. So I think I'll give that documentary a go.
Oh, yeah, it's really good. It's like an hour long. Just YouTube. I think it was done by BBC or ITV.
Yeah. I think it feels like such a... You know, a bit of a miscarriage of justice there as well. You know, that's such a short sentence for murder, and then for him to reoffend. Okay, I'll buy in a different country, but still.
I do wonder if the reason he only served 12 years was like good behaviour, or what happened to get him out of that soon. If anybody knows, or I'll probably have another bit of a dig on that, and I'll let you know. But I couldn't find anything. It was just he was released, and he does seem to have been quite a charismatic individual, and like I say, he's so popular at uni and engaged in all these activities. Could it be sort of a similar mask that he wore in prison in order to get early release? You can
more than likely
that.
But again, you'd think that people like the parole board would look at his behaviour whilst they were investigating the case, and how he's manipulated everything throughout. People don't change when it comes to things like that, I don't think.
No, not at all. I think probably it went in his favour with him being like, I did, like admitting that had killed her and showing remorse for it, staged or otherwise.
Yeah, that's
he was very much
fake remorse.
I really loved her, and I didn't want this to happen and stuff. And then that would have gone in his favour to get him a release, when it's quite clearly like bollocks.
Yeah. Oh.
It's just excruciatingly sad.
It is. Really sad.
And she seemed like such a sound girl.
Yeah, with so much promise.
I think I always get hung up on, like, I could have been friends with them people.
Yeah.
You know, like, if they come from a similar area or a similar age, or you find out they had the same interests as you, it really brings it home as, like, that could have been me.
Yeah. It's that connection, like you said, isn't it? And I think he reminds me a little bit of Mitchell Kwai.
Yes.
Like how he's caught in the media and stuff, but he's just not that intelligent.
No.
You know.
I think everyone, or at least a very high proportion of women, and probably indeed men, have been in relationships with someone who the intense emotions and, like... you're everything, you're my world, is really attractive at the very beginning, and soon it becomes very unattractive very
quickly. Yeah, that's a good point.
So I feel like we can all sort of relate to that as well.
Definitely.
So I hope that you enjoyed hearing more about this case, because it is interesting and but horrible to have happened.
Definitely.
Fab. So I think that was quicker than I thought it was going to be. There's not loads of theories for us to go through. We know what happened and it was shit.
Yeah, it's quite cut and dry, but really, really sad regardless.
Yeah. So I'm thinking next week, shall we just do some mini cases? Anything?
Yeah. Are we going to do... We had a discussion, didn't we, about...
did we?
Yeah. Well, we said, obviously, Rachel has like a link to your locality, didn't we? So we kind of said that perhaps we could do small cases that are... possibly close to our current geographical location.
Yeah, perfect.
Yeah.
So obviously, if you're listening to this and you're like, what are they on about? Kelly and I are both from Lancashire in the UK and Northwest.
Northwest.
If you don't know the geography of the UK that well, which I wouldn't be surprised at because I'm shit with geography of like countries that aren't my own, which is very
same.
It's not something I'm proud of, but just if you don't know where this is, you've probably heard of Manchester and you've probably heard of the Lake District. We're in between there.
Excellent.
That's the whole description.
I mean, we're from the Northwest, which is the best part of the UK.
Yeah, personally, I agree as well. We're going to find sort of some little local cases for the next episode, and I hope that you'll join us for that.
Definitely. Until then, stay safe, keep well.
Yeah.
Yeah, and we'll see you soon.
Bye.
Bye.